Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. The federal government wants to get its metadata legislation through Parliament this month. This issue, like other measures to tighten national security, presents challenges for the Labor Party. But the opposition is sticking firmly with a bipartisan approach. Jason Clare is opposition spokesman on communications, and he joins us today. Jason Clare, what do you say to those critics who argue that metadata retention is an unacceptable intrusion and Labor is not taking a tough enough line on it?
Well, this is a controversial area, and I can understand why people are concerned about the impact on their privacy. The work the committee did made it very clear to me that the bill in its current form is not good enough.
This is the parliamentary committee we're talking about.
That's right.
About.
That's the Parliamentary Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence and Security. It received more than 200 submissions and held a series of public hearings and private hearings. And what that evidence bore out for me were three things. One, that the legislation puts too much power in the hands of the Attorney General, George Brandis, to determine what the metadata is that must be retained and who should have access to it. Secondly, it doesn't provide enough protections for individuals over their own data and enough security of that data to be retained by telecommunications companies. And third, it doesn't provide in its current form sufficient oversight. If you're going to give law enforcement agencies more power, there's the risk of use or misuse, and oversight is critical there. And so the 39 recommendations of the committee focus very much in those three areas. Some of the key recommendations of the report are that it should be the Parliament that decides what metadata is retained, not George Brandis, and it should be the Parliament that decides which law enforcement agency should have access to it, again, not George Brandis, the Attorney General. We also made a number of other recommendations about the rights of individuals. At the moment, there's doubt about whether you or I can get access to our metadata from the telco that we have a contract with. We want to state in law that that should be the case and that you should have the right to access your data, that the data held by these companies should be encrypted to make it safer, that if the data is hacked into by somebody else, that you should receive an alert from the telecommunications company telling you that your data's been compromised. And also, if the purpose of this is for law enforcement, then it shouldn't be used for the purposes of civil proceedings. There was real concern when the government first announced this about using this data to chase people illegally downloading Game of Thrones. And what the committee said was, if the government's good to its word, it should prevent this data being used for other purposes in civil proceedings. Just one final point on oversight. The bill gets one thing right, and that is to give real investigative powers to the Ombudsman over state and federal law enforcement agencies. But what it doesn't do is give the Ombudsman the resources to do this job properly. In evidence, the Ombudsman said they need about a dozen staff to do this properly and significant extra funding. We've recommended that that must happen. And we've also taken a fairly big step in recommending that for the first time ever, this committee should have the same powers as its US equivalent and its UK equivalent, and that is the power to investigate the operational activities of our law enforcement and national security agencies. It's the first step in the reforms John Faulkner proposed last year.
Do you think, even though the committee is recommending safeguards, there will still be some concern among some of your parliamentary members and indeed the wider Labor Party's rank and file about this measure?
I think in an area as controversial like this, there's always going to be people on both sides of politics that are concerned about the use or the misuse of this data. Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop in the past have expressed that concern as well. And we still have at least three outstanding concerns that we want to prosecute. The first is to give that power to the committee over all law enforcement agencies and national security agencies across all the work they do. This is the Faulkner reforms, to give the committee real teeth. The second is the issue of where this data should be stored. In principle, we think the safer and better way is for this data to be stored in servers in Australia, not overseas. And thirdly, Labor strongly believes that journalists should be treated differently in this legislation, and that if law enforcement and security agencies want access to a journalist's metadata or telecommunications data, then they should first seek and receive a warrant from a judicial officer.
And this is presumably because governments undertake witch hunts when there are leaks and can use metadata to pursue those.
Journalists are different. That's why there are shield laws for journalists. If you have access to a journalist's sources, then it undermines press freedom. Journalists, as you know, Michelle, sometimes investigate the investigators. They're sometimes doing investigations into these agencies, and I think it would compromise the integrity of their work or the freedom of journalists' work if the same law enforcement agency made the decision about accessing their metadata. It should be done by a court or a tribunal under warrant.
You mentioned Malcolm Turnbull, Communications Minister. Have you had a good deal of cooperation from him and his office? How does that work?
On this area in particular?
This area in particular and more generally.
Well, Malcolm Turnbull introduced this legislation, but a lot of the work that's being done by the government in this area is not being done by Malcolm Turnbull. It seems like he's been pushed to the side here, and it's being done by George Brandis and his office. I get the impression Malcolm Turnbull's a little more focused on other things at the moment.
Well, one of those other things may be elevation. What sort of Prime Minister do you think Malcolm Turnbull would make?
Well, it's a good question. If you look carefully into what Malcolm said on the 7:30 report last night, he sent a not-so-subtle signal to his colleagues that if you get him the numbers, he's ready to challenge. He said his ticker's in good shape. And he also indicated something which I think is a bit of a concern. He said that his position on gay marriage is not that different to Tony Abbott's. Now, that's a nonsense. They have diametrically opposed positions. That's like Malcolm Turnbull saying he's a monarchist.
To be fair to Malcolm Turnbull, he was saying that they both thought the party room should decide whether there was a conscience vote. And he was confident there would be if there was a gay marriage law legislation come up, but they would vote different ways. Mm.
But on the substance of the issue, they have very different views. And I think what Malcolm is, it looks, trying to do is convince the waverers in his party that he's willing to give up his principles in order to get power. And that should concern people. You know, Malcolm's prided himself on being a conviction politician. If he turns his back on his position on climate change or gay marriage, then he'll demonstrate that he's more willing to get power than he is to stand up for the things he believes in.
But I wonder if you're making a bit of a preemptive strike here, because Malcolm Turnbull would be more of a threat to the Labor Party than Tony Abbott appears to be, at least on the polls, and he does appear to appeal to quite a lot of Labor voters.
Look, all politicians have got strengths and weaknesses. There's things about politicians that people will love and hate. One of the challenges that Malcolm Turnbull will have is that for a lot of people in electorates like mine in Western Sydney, they think there's no connection between somebody who's very wealthy that lives on the harbour and their daily lives in the suburbs of Sydney or Melbourne. The bottom line for Labor, though, is it doesn't matter who the leader of the Liberal Party is. We have to be better than them. We have to have better policies and a better argument for government. I said the other day when I was asked this question that it's a bit like asking the Australian cricket team who they'd like to play in the World Cup final. Bottom line is we've got to be better than the other side, and we've got to do enough and be good enough to earn back the support and respect of the Australian people.
Now, you mentioned your electorate in Western Sydney. It's an area where there's a high Muslim population, that cluster of electorates. How is the national security issue playing out there?
You know, what's happening on the other side of the world, that mess in Mesopotamia, is having a big impact on my community. It's a lightning rod for people who've had their minds poisoned by either people preaching bile or reading bad things on the internet to go over to the other side of the world and fight. I want to do bad things here. For the Muslim community, there's a lot of people that are frustrated that they feel like they've got an obligation to constantly reaffirm their loyalty to Australia. There's a lot of people that are angry that they get blamed for the action of others, and that's dangerous. As leaders, politicians, community leaders, religious leaders and others need to do everything they can to make sure that we bring the community together, because the greatest victims of what's happening in the Middle East are Muslims, and the greatest risk we face here in Australia is we won't meet this challenge properly unless we tackle it together as a community.
Do you know of any people from your electorate who've gone to fight with the Islamic State? Any families that have been affected in this way?
A lot of the stories that you see in the paper about people going overseas are people from the western suburbs of Sydney. So, and that is a fact. And
are you familiar with any of these families?
No, I'm not. No. But like everybody else, I worry about the risk that this poses to Australian citizens if people come back to Australia, having been in a warlike environment, having done all the terrible things that we see on our television at the moment, and the risk that might pose to Australians. So this is serious, and it's the sort of thing that governments and oppositions need to work constructively on together, take the politics out of it and try to work together to make sure that you've got the right laws in place. But laws can only do so much. The key here, I think, is building trust between governments and communities, and if we don't do that, it makes the job so much harder for our law enforcement agencies. It's been said before, and it's very true, that the greatest source of information and advice for the federal police and the state police is our Muslim community.
You spoke about the frustration of some in the Muslim community, but do you also find fear about their children, fear by women, for example, that they might be targeted by the people in the general community?
Yeah, it's a good question. You'll remember the raids that took place in September last year, Michelle, and in the aftermath of that, there were people being abused on the street. There was a woman that was pushed off a train in Melbourne. I had individuals in the community tell me that they were told by their families only shop in certain areas, only go together in groups. And I was very worried at that time that if something terrible happened in Australia, that we were going to see that on a much greater scale. Then the Sydney siege happened, and I expected that to happen. Something different happened that I didn't expect, and that is that the community reacted by coming together. A Muslim leader who I know very well went to Martin Place four times to lay flowers and spend time with the community. And a middle-aged Anglo-Celtic woman came up to him and gave him a hug and said, "Are you okay?" He started crying, and he told me afterwards he felt like he belonged more in that moment at that time than ever before. And I thought to myself then that if the purpose of what that man was trying to do, man Monis or ISIS is trying to do, is to divide us, then it had the reverse effect, and that's critical.
Let's turn to another issue, and this one in your portfolio, and that is media regulation. We had some indications from Malcolm Turnbull earlier that he was going to try to loosen the media laws. What's happened to that? Do you know? Do you think the government is going to go on with that? And what's your attitude?
Well, media reform's a minefield, a well-trodden minefield. I think Malcolm Turnbull understands that. And perhaps that's the reason why this is stagnated. What we said when this was first raised is that we need to see all elements of any media reform plan because one affects the other. There'd been speculation about changes to the reach rule that affects television stations, as well as the 2 out of 3 rule, which affects the ability of a media company to own television stations, newspapers and radio stations. We said at the time, we need to understand what the government's proposing to do in relation to anti-siphoning or sport on television as well, because that is very important to a lot of Australians. And ever since we said that, nothing's happened.
So you think it's gone into a black hole, really?
Well, it seems to be the case. It looks like another example of in the bottom drawer while Malcolm Turnbull focuses on other things.
One reason probably is that there's not agreement among the media companies on this. But one aspect of media relations that was very to the fore during Labor's period in government, especially the Gillard government, was the whole issue of News Limited and Labor's relations with News Limited. How are they now? Do you feel that Labor is still getting a very hard time from News Limited outlets?
Look, we deal with all media organisations on their merits. In the example I just gave you of the protection of journalism and press freedom in this metadata legislation, we've been talking to all of the news agencies about this issue. And we had a joint submission to the committee from News Limited, from Fairfax, from the ABC, SBS, and the major broadcasters.
I'm thinking more
in coverage. Oh, well, I just want to make the point here that in all these areas of public policy that are the responsibility of Malcolm Turnbull and my responsibility as a shadow minister to examine and look at, we've got a very professional and constructive relationship with News Limited and all of those other media organisations. And our view on press freedom, I think, is very similar to the views of all of those organisations.
The government this week announced measures to prop up the revenue of Australia Post, which will mean higher stamp prices. What do you think of this package? And do you think there's a case any longer for keeping Australia Post in government hands?
Well, to answer the second question first, I think yes. There certainly is. The Labor Party is opposed to the privatisation of Australia Post. The government, by the way, has said that they don't support the privatisation of Australia Post either. The Commission of Audit last year, when it was released, recommended the sale of Australia Post, and the government quickly came out and said they wouldn't do that. And so that's our expectation, that they will maintain that position. More generally on Australia Post, it's a great example of an organisation being transformed by the internet. People don't send letters like they did 20 years ago. You use email. But by the same token, we're receiving more parcels than ever before because we're buying things online. And this is having a big impact on Australia Post and the nature of the business. It needs reform. The question is, what sort of reform? The government has announced that it's going to introduce a two-speed mail delivery system with a stamp increase to a dollar. What we've said is we want to examine this in detail, but there are four fundamental things that we want the government to be focused on. First is, this shouldn't be used as an excuse to start closing post offices. There's one thing that people love about Australia Post more than anything else, and that's access to their local post office to do lots of things. The second is, it shouldn't be used as an excuse to start sacking thousands of people. We won't support forced redundancies. Australia Post has in the past adopted an approach of retraining and redeployment first and then voluntary redundancies if necessary. That's critical from our point of view. The third area we're concerned about is, what's the flow-on effect of these changes for the bush? In rural and regional Australia, mail is already delivered slower, so what will be the impact of these changes there? And then in terms of the stamp price, it shouldn't go unremarked that the stamp price will have increased by about 100% over the last decade or so. They're protecting people on concession cards, pensioners, by giving them still the 60-cent stamp. But for people on low incomes just above that, they've got to have a good hard look at what the impact of that might be. And also small businesses. Most of the mail we receive at the moment is either from government or from our bank or utilities, but there are a lot of small businesses who rely on Post to do their job, to make money. And we want Australia Post to have a good hard look at the potential unintended consequences of this on some small businesses.
Just finally, Labor's been sitting pretty in the polls for a long time now. Do you think that this can continue until the election campaign gets underway? Or do you think, as time goes on and there's more attention on Labor, you're going to have more of a struggle in the polls?
Well, I think the Australian community have quite fairly marked Tony Abbott very hard. They're angry about the broken promises. They're angry about the budget because any objective analysis of it shows that it was unfair. And they're irritated by some of the evidence of incompetence. The Prince Philip knighthood is a very good example of that. But come the next election, they're going to compare the two sides. And as I said earlier, we need to demonstrate that we're ready to govern. We need to demonstrate that we're ready to earn the right to govern, that we've earned back the respect of the Australian people. Now, that's no easy task. No political party has won government after one term in opposition in over 80 years. So I don't think we should underestimate how difficult it is. But part of that is making it very, very clear that we've got the policies to implement to set Australia up for the future. Part of that is a stronger economy. But another key plank of that is a fairer country. You'll always hear the government talk about the importance of a stronger economy. You'll never hear them talking about a fairer country. And it's only Labor that will deliver the sort of reforms, whether it's Medicare, university reforms, superannuation, that will set us up as a fairer country for the future. And that'll be a key part of our argument for a return to government at the next election.
Jason Clare, thanks for being with us today. And that's all from the Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. Back with you soon. I'm Michelle Grattan.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.